Hello and welcome to the Magis podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. With World Leaders Summit last weekend, China took another major step to realize its ambitious project called One Belt, One Road, in other words, OBOR. The project consists of a vast network of trading routes spanning from China to the Middle East, Africa, and Europe. If it is implemented, given its geographical location, Central Asia will play a crucial role in its implementation. As much as this might sound a dream come true for landlocked Central Asia, but it comes with an unprecedented cost of nearly $1 trillion. And it's a big question where all these investments will come from and what are the obligations of Central Asians, which ultimately raises another question: that what will this mean to Central Asia? What are the possible seen and unseen consequences in China's future rule in the region? On today's Majlis, we hope to bring some clarity to these questions. To do so, I'm joined from Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, Przemyslav Ozirsky, Deputy Director of Central Asian Strategic Center for Analysis, Dialogue and Development. From London, Dr. Rafael Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. From Spain, Nicolas Di Pedro, Research Fellow at the Barcelona Center for International Affairs. And from Prague, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much.
Very nice to have you, gentlemen. So with this, Dr. Pantucci, you have a great deals of insight on Chinese aspect of the project. Let's start with you by recalling specifications of this project. What does it contain and what the Chinese thinking on this?
I think that when we're looking at the sort of Chinese motivations behind this big project, I think Central Asia is really important to bear in mind, because when we're thinking about this big Belt and Road strategy that we see was sort of, you know, honored in this giant conference that was held in Beijing over the weekend, we're actually seeing in many ways a kind of internationalization of a strategy and of an approach that had been going on in Central Asia really for the past 15 to 20 years, I would argue, which was in essence a domestic strategy at its heart, which is about developing China's western regions. And if you're going to develop China's western regions of Xinjiang, you're going to have to open them up to the world and find ways of connecting them, because ultimately, you know, Xinjiang is as landlocked as any of the Central Asian countries. And right. So in order to do that, you need to open up sort of trade routes, you need to open up roads, you need to open up pipelines and connectivity and markets into Central Asia to ultimately help Xinjiang sort of connect up to the world. And so in many ways, what we're seeing happen at the weekend is this big Belt and Road conference, which is in many ways a kind of replica of this sort of strategy and this sort of initiative that had been going on in Central Asia for such a long time, then get transformed onto the global stage. Now, what does that mean for Central Asia specifically? Well, what it really means is that when we're talking about the kind of Belt and Road, we're talking about something that actually has been going on in Central Asia for some time. And this is really about sort of China trying to open up its regions and trying to sort of encourage its companies to go out and ultimately try to improve the economic lot of its westernmost regions, and doing that through the sort of increase of trade and connectivity with Central Asia.
Trade and connectivity, opening up, these headlines that I get from your comments. So looking into this from Central Asian perspective, Dr. Ozirsky, is Central Asian's thinking matched with the Chinese vision of this project?
I believe that that is the idea of connectivity from the Chinese point of view. And if you look at the Central Asia and the OBOR, first of all, we need to understand that is the close neighborhood of China. So we have the Xinjiang from the one side and Eastern China. And we have Central Asia. So the OBOR is being seen as the chance of integrating both regions, like Xinjiang, Central Asia, in mutual interest. If we think about the Central Asia from the Chinese perspective, it's not only about opening roads, it's also about developing the region that is still very fragile. The region that needs much more investments to integrate within, internally, and provide, let's say, provide secure environment for China in general. The OBOR is a chance for Central Asia. I can say from the part of Kyrgyzstan, from the perspective of Kyrgyzstan, it's very important for the Kyrgyzstan to open for China and also use the Obor projects, for example, China-Kyrgyz-Uzbekistan Railroad and the China-Kyrgyzstan-Tajikistan Railroad to open to new regions, generally to escape from this landlocked perspective and open for the world.
Okay, Bruce, let me bring you here. So opening up, connectivity, development of the region, three headlines I got. So how does it sound from Central Asian perspective? We understand the situation of Kyrgyzstan. Are the other countries ready for this? Turkmenistan, for example, is it ready to jump into this caravan?
Well, I would say that generally across Central Asia, they're ready to join it. You know, there's one thing that we always got to remember when we talk about really trade with China in general, but certainly in this expanded form of Obor, is that, you know, after independence in 1991, despite a lot of pledges about investment in projects in Central Asia, not really a whole lot happened out there for all that time. And, you know, in the decade, little more than a decade, that China's actually been very active in Central Asia, we've seen a lot of these projects that were sponsored by China and largely funded by them that really just pushed through. Russia had a lot of fair words about investment, but really, you know, it didn't, not even half of the things that they promised for Central Asia ever happened. Other players in, you know, Japan and South Korea helped out a little bit. You know, the United States, European Union, not so much. So for a country like Turkmenistan, say, where there really wasn't a whole lot of investment, well, you got China, they signed a deal for gas that they want to buy from Turkmenistan. They build three of the four pipelines, you know, in just a few years' time. They're still not operating at full capacity, but, I mean, they're there. And so for the Central Asians, I think they're locked in with China just because really that was the only option that was really financially working out all the time for them. They've had a lot of promises, a lot of pledges that didn't come to reality. But in the Chinese case, the money is there and the projects, we see that they take off and they work and they're operating now. So I would say all of Central Asia would like to cooperate as much as possible without losing their sovereignty, obviously, with China.
Let's imagine that they are ready, though I don't see how Turkmenistan is opening up for foreign investment. But on the other aspect of the topic, let me bring you Nicholas here. So this weekend's summit was huge with 30 heads of the state present. Obviously a big sign of political support. But what are the plans for the financing of the project? As I understand, we are talking about $1 trillion. Where the hard currency will be coming from?
Well, that's a big question, right? It is unclear where the funding will come from. And this is really interesting, I mean, because Chinese are really saying, are insisting on the idea that the project is neutral from a geopolitical and, if you want, from an ideological point of view. So there is no any Eurasian identity behind or Eurasian ambitions in the terms of identity or power projection. But on the other hand, the economic logic underlying the project is still unclear. I mean, it's pretty clear that if the infrastructure were already there, it would be interesting basically to connect Western Europe with China. But if you have to invest all this, and if you don't have local ownership and the local transit countries are not necessarily ready, everything is pretty unclear. And despite the fact that Chinese authorities are insisting on this neutrality from a geopolitical point of view, insisting that it's basically about trade, shared prosperity and development, which I agree, I mean, the project offers a lot potentially to the Central Asian republics, but it's mainly perceived by everyone else, or at least by the Central Asians, Russia and Western Europeans, as a project which has huge geopolitical and strategic implications. And this is what is really blocking or will be something that will be necessarily to address by Chinese if they really want the locals, Central Asians and others, to take ownership and move forward with their support to the project.
Rafael, can I bring you in here about the finance of the project? So yes, it's a big one. It looks very nice on the paper, but money, where it's coming from?
So, I mean, the money, I think, is of course, you know, ultimately, it's the money that talks, right? And I think what's interesting about the money is a lot of the money is, of course, coming from China. If we're looking at the reason, I mean, as I think Bruce very correctly pointed out, you know, in Central Asia's sort of relatively young independent history, there have been lots of promises that have materialized about different countries coming in and doing all sorts of game-changing things, but they haven't really shown up. I think what's interesting about the Chinese investment is that they have talked up a big game and then some stuff has materialized. It hasn't quite materialized to the volumes that are sometimes talked about, but something has actually happened. And I think what's interesting is that we've actually seen a kind of shift in a lot of these countries and them becoming incredibly reliant in some ways on Chinese investment. And I think Turkmenistan is a very good case in point of this, where we have a country that essentially started suddenly to redevelop its kind of infrastructure of its gas sales to really become very dependent on China. And then suddenly when China suddenly decided it didn't need actually all of this gas that it was sort of talking about, and in fact a fourth pipeline wasn't necessary, You suddenly see the Turkmen starting to get a bit concerned about the fact that they've really locked themselves in with a client, with a customer who actually, you know, doesn't maybe want as much as they want, and you see a lot of activity happening in other directions. But in terms of the actual financing for this, a lot of this is coming from China, and it's coming from the Chinese policy banks. And the sort of biggest players in this regard are, of course, the China Development Bank and the China Exim Bank. But, you know, we can also see that some of the other big banks in China, like Bank of China or China Construction Bank or ICBC, you know, are sort of coming in and offering a lot of this money. And a lot of this money is sort of bilateral loans. And often they're linked loans, whereby the country, you know, China at a sort of government-to-government level will authorize the loan of a large amount of money for country X, let's say Kyrgyzstan, to build or refurbish, let's say, a refinery. And they put sort of the money is offered as a loan. Then ultimately the loan is used to get a Chinese company to come and actually implement the project. And so what we have is these kind of linked loans. The other new interesting angle, which is sort of more an innovation that we've seen coming out under Xi Jinping in particular, because I think that sort of model that we'd seen before was where most of the funding was coming from, and it was something that was very much bilateral government to government, is the injection of the creation of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, which is kind of China's contribution to the kind of world order of international financial institutions. And this was an initiative which, you know, I think has got a lot of airplay and has got a lot of attention in the media as sort of the vehicle of how China is funding this big Belt and Road initiative. In fact, it's a bit of a kind of red herring, because if you look at the AIIB, it's actually not very large. And if you look at the sort of big amounts of money that are actually being injected by China into these countries, it's not being done through the AIIB, which is much more being constructed in the model of the kind of Asian Development Bank or something else. And so is actually a sort of more independent body, which is sort of being steered by China, but actually has a sort of border governance, a way of structuring it, of offering its loans and doing its projects, which is actually fairly independent of the Chinese government. A lot of the sort of major investments that we see happening into Central Asia are in fact bilateral government-to-government loans, or sort of loans by Chinese banks to Chinese companies to come and implement projects in third countries with sort of assurances and sovereign debt guarantees provided by the local government. But ultimately, it's a sort of an official kind of loan from the Chinese institution to either the government or directly to the Chinese company.
Okay, let me put this very in a simple way. So lots of money coming from China, understood. So when you start building the project, like piece by piece, imagine if you are building a bridge in Tajikistan, or you are constructing an office building in Bishkek, or maybe a restaurant next to the road, or maybe port in Turkmenistan. So finance for these kind of projects will be coming from China, or Central Asians will be paying for that?
Well, I mean, I think, look, in a lot of these cases, frankly, you're in a lot of Central Asian countries that you're talking about, the country does not necessarily have the money. And I think what you're seeing in a lot of these cases is them taking on these loans from the Chinese authorities. And in some cases, you can see that there's been these loans are being taken on with a certain level of care and attention. And, you know, there's a thought to how we're going to pay it back. But in some Central Asian contexts, you do question about how ultimately that money is going to get paid back. I think the important thing we have to remember about a lot of this Belt and Road activity is that this is not a giant aid project. This is a very sort of commercially minded concept from the Chinese perspective. The money is offered at loans to these countries, and the loans, you know, I've spoken to people at international financial institutions in Central Asia who will say that these loans are at fairly understandable rates, and it's sort of, you know, they're not exorbitant, you're not getting gouged out of this. But there is a real question, I think, in some countries about how it is they're actually going to pay back some of these loans that they've taken on, and whether they're saddling themselves with a sort of burden of debt to China that's going to be very difficult for them to pay back. But I think there's sort of two sides to that equation, because you see, on the one hand, there's a question about how these countries are going to pay it back and what the sort of level of debt that they're giving themselves to China is. But on the other hand, you have to remember that in a lot of these cases, it's Chinese companies that are coming to implement the projects. And one of the other aspects we have to remember about this sort of project, about this vision in many ways, is that part of the idea from China's perspective is not only to sort of open up Xinjiang to the world, but it's also to encourage Chinese companies to go out and to try to keep some Chinese companies sort of busy and keep them sort of funded. So in some ways, in the, you know, while this project, you know, there is a question about how the money will necessarily get paid back, there's a question in my mind about how much necessarily China is expecting to get back. And if in some ways they've already kind of achieved their goals with these, in terms of getting their companies into these countries, in terms of building the infrastructure that they want to open up Xinjiang, and that's sort of achieving the goal. And then maybe if, you know, country X is unable to pay back the loan, well, you know, they maybe will extract something else out of this country, a mining concession or something like that. Or maybe they'll do what they've done in some African context, which is sort of write the debt off.
Dr. Przemyslaw, let me bring you here, like what the Dr. Rafael was talking about. Like there are lots of buildings to be constructed, lots of things to be built yet before this project really implemented. That requires lots of money. And in case of Central Asian country do not have resources to build that, and which these days in bad economic conditions, this is the case in many countries in Central Asia, so China will be giving them loan to build, and then as a part of the condition, the Chinese company will come to build that project. So money will, another way, going back to China. Yes, it's good, it's a big project, Kyrgyzstan a part of that, it's a nice part of the story, but the other aspect of the story, are they discussed in public?
Yes, it's discussed in public. Usually the discussion about, let's say, participation of the Chinese companies, that they actually work for their own loans. There's this huge discussion within the society. It's also politically motivated that it's not, don't give the employment for the local people, I would say. That is the easiest, let's say, explanation. Concerning the financing, there is also the question if it would be, the again, the scam, like African scam for like investments for resources, and how it would be made. Because it's normal in the case, I believe, in case of Kyrgyzstan, that some resources would be developed with China's help, with China's investments, and they could help to repay maybe some investments and guarantee some investment. I would say that if we look at the investment in Central Asia, in generally, in China, we see also the tendency from China that China is looking to share risk. So China not always want to take this 100% of the project, want to have investment from outside. And there's also the chance from the Kyrgyz side is looking that China could moderate, could attract other countries to invest in Kyrgyzstan. So maybe like 50-50, 20-20. So like to divide the risk and divide cost of some long-term investments. There is also the idea of Kyrgyz China as a fund. Still, this would be like the fund that would cooperate, would stimulate cooperation between those two countries. But still, we don't know how it would work. There is a similar fund working in Kyrgyzstan, but it's Kyrgyz-Russian Development Fund. And this has really like a good story of the success of investing small and middle enterprises. And still, we don't know. If it would be the same model or the model that would also support infrastructural projects.
Let me present another model, Bruce, to you. I was reading a leaked document published on Dawn newspaper of Pakistan about the Pakistani leg of this Obor project, which gives detailed information about it. Looking into the document, you get the sense that China will have huge say in every aspect of the project, designing, construction of it, and management of the project when it is completed. It talks about giving low-interest loans to Pakistan to build these projects. In the same paragraph, it says Chinese companies will have advantageous conditions to get into the market, sounding like they will lend money and they will provide the services and manage the project when completed. Is this sound a feasible plan for Central Asia?
Well, depending on the project, I suppose to some extent that's already present in Central Asia. There's a lot of Chinese investment, for instance, in Kazakhstan's oil industry. And we know that, you know, as all with all Chinese projects, and as we've heard here already, that if you take Chinese money and they invest in a project, then you also acquire Chinese workers as part of the workforce that goes out there. And of course, they send some management along, too. It's the same with the road construction in Kyrgyzstan, where the Chinese send their own workers. They do employ locals too, but they send their own workers. And really the people who are in charge of building the roads are all Chinese. They're the managers of the project. The machinery is all comes from China. So there already is that element that exists. The longer term implications of this are a little harder to say because, of course, we've only had 10 years. I was never under the impression that the Chinese wanted ownership of a lot of this. They certainly want a presence on the ground because, of course, Central Asia is notorious for corruption and money seems to disappear all the time. So rightly, I would say, the Chinese wish to have their own people there to make sure that the money they send is all spent for the purpose that it was sent there. And I, like I said, I can't fault them on that. Longer term, I don't know how much interest they have in some of these projects once they get up and operating. And of course, this is one of the big questions is, you know, how much time has been given to training, too. It is one thing to build pipelines and compressor stations, for instance, for gas shipments. Now, on the ground, do you have all the people that are going to be able to maintain those things for 20, 30, 40 years down the road? You know, this is a question, too. And it's the same with something as simple as a road. Fine, they put the asphalt down on the road. Now everyone can drive and get places much faster than they used to. Is there an infrastructure in these countries that can support maintenance of this road? Do they have the machinery to be able to keep this thing up and running all the time? Or is it going to be the case that when these things fall apart, they have to turn once again to the Chinese, get another loan, and have Chinese workers come out there again to fix what they built originally 5-10 years earlier?
Oh, what's the answer for that? Maybe Nicholas or Dr. Rafai?
Yeah, well, if I can react to the three previous interventions by Bruce, Raffaello, and Premislav, which I think are dealing with something which is very much linked and is related to the scheme that Raffaello has described, regarding Chinese policies towards Xinjiang and later on Central Asia, which I fully agree with what he has said. But the problem here lies on the fact that seen from Central Asia and now growingly also from Pakistan, what they fear is that this project, which has been extremely successful, or these policies have been extremely successful regarding the transformation of Xinjiang and opening up the region, developing the region and all that, but particularly Central Asians, and it's pretty clear when it comes to Kyrgyz and many Kazakhs, what they fear is to face the same fate of the Uyghurs, because this project, as you know, has basically benefited, or at least the Uyghurs don't feel that they have benefited as much as other, particularly Han Chinese in China. And so there is some sort of paradox here in the sense that the Chinese policies have been extremely successful in Xinjiang, but at the same time, the level of unrest among Uyghurs is probably higher than ever before. And this is connected to what Premislav was saying regarding the compatibility of this project with for instance, the Eurasian Union or any others. And we have to keep in mind that when the Eurasian Union, or at least the customs union, was established, one of the reasons or one of the logics behind was particularly and precisely to prevent or to face the Chinese competition, because the Central Asians and also Russia, they fear Chinese competition. And this is very much an issue that that should be considered when we think about the feasibility and the prospect of this project. Because opening up Central Asia, which I agree, I mean, Xinjiang is not anymore a landlocked periphery of China. But so for Central Asia, this might be definitely positive in terms of opening up to the world, in terms of receiving investment and all that. But what they fear is not really benefiting from this project, except some elites. And in this regard, the wave of protests in Kazakhstan last year, when it only with a rumor that this reform of the land law will allow Chinese to buy Kazakh land, is very telling and is quite representative of these fears. And regarding Pakistan, there is a growingly a similar pattern, and there is a growing concern among some sectors in Pakistan. And now they are calling the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor as a sort. I mean, it was today or 2 days ago published an interesting article in one Pakistani newspaper calling this project the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor as a sort of new East India Company, meaning that the pattern is a very colonial pattern.
Obviously, you know, I brought the Pakistan example because there was a document that we could look into that there is obviously a serious concern in Pakistan about increasing Chinese involvement. In the document, they are talking about Chinese companies getting involved in the agriculture sector, harvesting their own plants, and then building up fertilizers. I don't see a Central Asian farmer has the chance to stand against if this is the true picture of the project.
I mean, if I could come in, because I think you're raising some really interesting points, and I think you're getting to the nub of what I think the Chinese are confronting in terms of the problems going forwards, be it in Pakistan or be it in Central Asia. I think we have to look at this in another way. So I think in the first instance, an important aspect to remember is that I don't think this has all been very centrally planned out from Beijing. I think what's fascinating in many ways, and again, I'm looking into the case of Central Asia, I'd argue that what's been happening has been happening for about 15 to 20 years. And it happened in a sort of natural way, in the sense that there was this huge push to develop the West because the Chinese saw that they needed to develop their Western regions. And so the investment and the attention was really in Xinjiang. But then there's no kind of logic to developing Xinjiang if the regions around it aren't. And so then you see this sort of force going out. And so what you end up seeing is something that sort of happens by force of this sort of economic geography within the country that sort of then spills over into the borders. But then I don't think you ever saw any of this central planning happening in Beijing about what this meant. What is the consequence of when you as a country go into a country like Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan and become suddenly, you know, within the space of a short period of time, the biggest sort of economic player in this country? That has consequences. It has political consequences. And I don't think that Beijing has really sat down and thought through what does that actually mean and then how do we address this? And so in many ways, what I think you're seeing here is, you know, I think the colonial example is always a very loaded one. But it's actually one that I think you could argue is sort of, you could see how it's moving in that direction, but I don't think it's moving in that direction necessarily in a totally well-formed, preconceived way from Beijing's perspective. And I think what's really interesting is that as we're seeing more of this pushback and the commentary that you've seen in Dawn recently, and you know, but it's been coming for some time, frankly, you've seen a lot of these issues. If you look at the, at a sort of regional level in Pakistan, all the different provinces get very agitated about whether they're getting enough the CPEC, what problems they see with the CPEC projects, how they think it should be here rather than there, how they want more investment, how they want that, you know, all of these tensions are actually ones that I'd argue you've seen in Central Asia for some time. I mean, what was fascinating to me about traveling around Central Asia doing research trying to look at this question in particular was when you went to sort of Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan in particular, you found a real kind of sense of Sinophobia, a real sense of concern and fear about what this sort of Chinese wave of investment actually meant and what it was going to mean for the longer term for these countries and their sort of ability to maintain their independence and their identity and how much they were sort of swapping the previous sort of master in Moscow for a master in Beijing. And there's a real sort of question there. And again, you can see China started to give some thoughts about how do we manage some of these soft power relations. And you can see that in some of the investments they've done in scholarships to students, in terms of the Confucius Institutes to teach kids Mandarin, in terms of a lot of the other efforts you can see of them doing sort of a lot of attempts to figure out how they can win over local people's affection and support for this kind of bigger project. But they're really having some issues around that. And I think you're only going to see those issues become more going forward. But then I think we have to track back. Sorry, just to end on a side point of, I think something that I think Bruce made a point of earlier, which is that, you know, the other issue is that when you're looking at Central Asia, where is the other options coming from? You know, and if we're looking around the region, you can see that Moscow is not coming with giant buckets of investment to come in. The Indians have sort of talked about it, but never quite produced it. The Japanese and the Koreans, the South Koreans, are interesting because they are actually, there is some evidence of activity happening there. But really, you know, these are countries that are sort of limited by their options, and they need the investment and they need the support. And if they don't want it to just be sort of IFIs, which come with all sorts of baggage and, you know, sometimes are quite difficult to actually secure, then, you know, you see China as a very sort of tempting option, and you'll see them default go to it and accept it because there is kind of an absence of other options necessarily on the table.
Yeah, you know, obviously this is an interesting option, but what is the cost of this option? So we will continue the discussion on this topic after the short break. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis Podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. Let me recap the discussion that today on the Majlis, we are joined by Przemyslaw Ozierski, Deputy Director of Central Asian Studies Center for Analysis, Dialogue and Development, Dr. Rafael Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, Nicolas Di Pedro, Research Fellow at the Barcelona Center for International Affairs, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. To continue the discussion with China's giant trade project over its possible impact on Central Asia. Yeah, it sounds a dream plan to hook up with major markets for Central Asians, but there are serious implications and questions. And one of them is security. And again, I'm referring to that document which was published in Undaun newspaper in Pakistan. So we understand that majority of the investment is coming from China. And China will be interested to have those investments secured, protected. In that sense, they were, with the Pakistani authorities, they were talking about how to secure those investments, how to plan for the security arrangements for that. And within that phrase, they are even talking about creating safe cities, safe zones. So what kind of arrangements is there in Central Asia? What are the potentials to arrange the security of those investment which will be coming from China, Bruce?
I mean, this is a huge and important question. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, the Chinese would like to think that when they're investing many billions of dollars into a region, that it's going to be well protected and they won't have any problems with this. How far are you willing to go if you're in Beijing to protect these projects? That is a big question. Certainly, they wouldn't use their military for something like this. Now we know. From earlier this year, there was reports that they'd hired a firm, which I believe was called Frontier Services, but it's run by the same guy who founded Blackwater in the United States. So they have hired a private security firm. And in this case, they're supposed to set up an office in Xinjiang, which will be responsible for China's overseeing and recommending security procedures for operations in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, for instance. But this is a huge question about what how far are they willing to go to protect some of these, with oil pipelines, gas pipelines, things like that, that are running from Central Asia, which they need. But what happens if something starts to, the stability factor kind of decays in some of these countries, and how far are they willing to go? Especially since, as we've heard, there's this Sinophobia that's going on now in some of these places too. People would rather see less Chinese than more. And if you have to introduce Chinese security guards, which, for instance, we know work in Turkmenistan at the Gulkanish field, you can't have such a very high profile. That's one of China's successes in Central Asia in general, is that as much as possible they've kept a real low profile. So I'm not really sure what the answer is to how you secure these kind of investments, not for China.
Dr. Pishmislav, so how far Central Asians will be open to the idea that Chinese will be coming to secure or providing protection to the investment that they will make in Central Asian countries?
I agree that there is a certain level of Chinophobia in Kyrgyzstan, and even we could look in the history and in the great epos Manas. But all the investment, actually, there is a problem inside Kyrgyzstan with the governance, with the security sector, and how it would secure the investment, not only China's investments, but any other foreign investment, generally about the climate, investment climate in the country. If there would be some private companies securing, I guess, and I'm sure that Kyrgyzstan would not allow for the private companies working openly to secure Chinese investments. On the other hand, Kyrgyzstan could welcome, I would say, the cooperation with the STO in anyhow, somehow, because the main threat, security threat for the Chinese investment, it's from terrorism. China is identified such threat as a threat from the Uyghur minority and some members of this minority involved in terrorist activities.
Interesting. Dr. Pishmislav, you mentioned the possible role for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in this. Do you think that is a possibility, Nicholas?
Well, so far it's unclear, in the sense that when it comes to security, the contradictions are even more striking and evident, because at some point China will need to take a bigger role when it comes to security and this stuff. But at the same time, Central Asian countries plus Russia are reluctant to this role, because there is some sort of distrust in the long-term Chinese policies and ambitions. So it is unclear. Also because Russia wants to retain this leading role when it comes to security, and particularly in the military domain. But yes, they face this common threat of terrorism coming from mostly Afghanistan, South Asia, and this shared concern. But on the other hand, if we and I fully agree with what Premislav has said in regarding the differences between Pakistan and Central Asia. And in Central Asia, if we talk about security, very likely the conflicts are not, or the main threats are not going to come from transborder terrorism, or maybe, and definitely not conventional threats. So it will be related to domestic issues, more related to governance and other issues. And there, China has a very narrow-minded approach, like the local regimes. But then it's unclear whether it will be a provider of security or insecurity for the Central Asian citizens, not the regimes. The regimes is a different story. But if we talk about the people of Central Asia, then it's unclear. And as Bruce has said, there is probably an exaggerated but an overstated and not based in facts, but there is this xenophobia in the region. It's very clear in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. Let's remember that any time when there are riots and problems in Kyrgyzstan, all Chinese interests tend to be one of the main targets for several reasons. And any time that there is a significant presence of Chinese workers, both in Kyrgyzstan and sometimes even in Tajikistan, this triggers concerns and anger among locals, because they think that they cannot really compete, not only with the workers, but mainly with the Chinese companies.
Interesting. Dr. Rafael, we were talking about the security thing. Now, look at this picture from Central Asia. China taking front seat in the investment. China taking front seat in owning those projects. And you are seeing more and more Chinese in your streets. There is already some level of xenophobic feelings in some of the Central Asian countries. Now, China is taking more rule in security of the region. So what kind of picture does it give for Central Asians about long-term ambitions of China?
I mean, I think it's a real question for Central Asians. And I actually would go much further in some ways than people are saying about China's security role in the region. I think actually that we should look beyond the SCO, because the SCO is an organization that I would argue China has somewhat lost interest in and has for some time. I mean, yes, it's got a Chinese name and it comes from a sort of Chinese inception, and they're still, you know, they host it in Beijing. But if you look at sort of activity on the ground, you can see so much more happening at a bilateral level, with China worrying about its security concerns and the PLA playing a role in doing training in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, providing equipments of all sorts, building border posts on the Tajik-Afghan border, having Chinese soldiers that are increasingly showing up in all sorts of odd places. To even if we look at the SCO, where we can see an organization that, you know, while rhetorically is very much focused around counterterrorism, focused around these security questions, but actually for many of the reasons that other colleagues have already sort of outlined, in terms of tensions within the organization, in terms of Uzbekistan not liking multilateral formats, preferring bilateral, and so sort of blocking any initiatives there, in terms of Russia being worried about it sort of being place, you know, we can see that the SCO actually hasn't done a huge amount in terms of in delivering, you know, answers to security problems regionally. And so what you've seen is China kind of move beyond that. And so we saw late last year the creation of this QCCM, this Quadrilateral Coordination and Cooperation Mechanism, which was an organization established by at a Chinese initiative of a sort of between the PLA, between the sort of the chiefs of army staff of China, of Afghanistan, of Pakistan, and Tajikistan. And it's very much focused around sort of China's concerns in those countries and the sort of threats that they see, and that little border area that sort of goes around the Wuhan corridor that they all sort of share. And, you know, this is a sort of sub-regional multilateral mechanism that China's been pushing forwards, which, if we think about it, is one that should be the issues that it's focused on and ones that should already be addressed by the SCO. But I think the fact is China sees that the SCO isn't going to deal with these issues, so it goes ahead and creates another format to try to focus some attention on these and deal with its concerns there. And my understanding is that this was done without even particularly informing Moscow. Moscow sort of later discovered, when it got a bit concerned, that, you know, the Tajiks, which are, you know, members of the CSCO, an organization, a multilateral security organization that Russia is very much a dominant figure in, you know, was going off and joining this other security mechanism. So I think that we can see that the SCO is sort of being bypassed by China. And when we think about the SCO as an entity in relation to OBOR, I would refer people back to last year when Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, visited Bishkek. And he made some interesting comments there, where he started to talk about the SCO as something that could operate under the framework of the Belt and Road Initiative. And so we can see how this sort of big vision that Xi Jinping has shot out is sort of slowly absorbing all these other little bits and pieces. But I think it does, you know, it is a really interesting question, because I think the kind of the piece of the Central Asian puzzle that we had seen China maybe addressing less was the security piece. There was very much a perception of a division of responsibilities, with Moscow doing the security while China did the economics. But actually now I'd argue that that picture is being eroded as we see China taking an increasingly front role. And I think that's really down to the fact of some of the other issues that colleagues have been raising, which is, you know, you're looking at massive investments, lots of people going out there, lots of interests and important interests that are linked to domestic Chinese concerns, and a need then from China's perspective to be able to be certain that they can be safe and that they can guarantee the protection of these, and no longer them seeing that they can just sort of, you know, abrogate this responsibility to local actors in Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan. But, you know, I think from a local perspective, that does, I imagine, raise a lot of sort of red flags and a lot of concerns. And I think how China manages those concerns is really going to be one of the very interesting and difficult questions for Central Asia, you know, going forwards, at least for the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have to conclude our discussion, but just a few final notes. So in the face of all this, what is the long-term implications of this for Central Asia? And Bruce, let's start with you.
Well, it's going to change from country to country, but certainly in the case of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, they're going to end up incurring crippling debts, which they probably will never be able to pay off. I don't know how much China would be willing to write off for them, but it might be the same situation for Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan in the long run, too. Kazakhstan is probably in shape where it can take these loans and get them back, but the durability of some of these infrastructure projects that are already built or are being built in Central Asia is a big question. Will they last without a huge investment in the future? And can these countries pay back the money that they're taking loans from China's Exim Bank and the China Development Bank? And right now, I would say no. And a lot of these projects, even with the best intentions, probably won't be moneymakers. So it's not a question of the Central Asians. In the case of the Turkmenistan pipelines, for instance, China's getting paid back because they're part of it's being paid off in the gas. But some of these other projects, roads, railways, and things like that, those projects can't pay back the money, not anytime really soon. So it's going to probably leave the poorer countries a lot more poor, although better connected. And even the rich ones will be better connected, but probably not as well off financially as they think they're going to be.
Okay, Dr. Przemyslaw?
I would be much more optimistic.
Okay.
And I believe that China cannot just simply ask return debts, return loans, and would consider that this is close neighborhood, that this area, this region must develop. And develop in a way that would be beneficial for China, not only for economy, but also for security. And also we need to remember that it's not only about infrastructure such as road, railroads, it's also there are different projects, there's digital Silk Road, digital Casa, that could simply like change the way we think about the economies of those countries and for the economy of Kyrgyzstan, and move the countries forward with modernization, with certain modernization. So I would finish more optimistically
for the project. Just a counterpoint to yours, Dr. Przemyslaw. My understanding of China is that it will ask every penny it gives to anyone. Perhaps, Dr. Rafael, you might have better understanding of China. So what's your take?
So, you know, I think the real question here is how the Central Asian countries and governments in particular manage these investments. You know, do they do it in a way where they kind of end up becoming very supplicant and supine to these or to China, or do they find a way of taking advantage of this investment? I think ultimately they have to think about this really as a commercial enterprise. And this is something that China is doing clearly for its own interest. All countries do things in their own interests at the end of the day. But how can you harness that to find a way of taking advantage of it for yourself? Ultimately, there's countries that need the investment, they need the support. And so if they can find ways of making sure that they establish red lines, that they establish that there is a local benefit, that there are locals who are being trained up, that they are building infrastructure that is really helping the country, not just helping China, then I think that they're going to potentially be able to really come out of this in a very positive way. But it will require a lot on them being able to manage that, and a lot on governance locally being able to find ways of pushing back and of managing these investments.
Okay, final point, Nicolas. So do you see this is really happening? this project is really happening?
I'm not able to have a clear say on that, but definitely if we look at the last 25 years in Central Asia, there are clearly two main vectors of transformation and two big new things. And one was clearly the role of China, the opening up of China and the relationship with China and the presence of China, which is growing dramatically. And this project is a clear example of that. And the other one is the growing but steadily growth of the role of Islam at the cultural level, social level, and let's see if political. So these are the two vectors that we will be looking at when we look at the region in the mid to long term. And definitely the role of China is going to be a key when it comes to the future of Central Asia. But I think still the local developments and when it comes to the local regimes will be the key factor shaping the future of Central Asia.
Okay. Thank you very much for insightful comments, Nicolas Di Pedro, Research Fellow at the Barcelona Center for International Affairs, Dr. Przemyslaw Ozierski, Deputy Director of Central Asian Strategic Center for Analysis, Dialogue and Development, Dr. Rafael Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. Thank you very much for your time and thoughts, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.